for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Congress may be taking a break, but for healthcare policy lobbyists, there's no let up. So far this year, more than $250 million have been spent by lobbyists in the effort to shape the debate. And many say these efforts are paying off. Joining me to talk about how lobbyists are influencing what is and is not being considered in the healthcare overhaul, Norman Ornstein. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. David Leventhal, the Center for Responsive Politics, and Andrew Kohut. He's director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We'll also welcome your tweets and your messages from Facebook. First, we're joined by Wendell Potter. He's senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He is a former health industry director of public relations. Good morning to you, Wendell. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diana. Thank you for this opportunity.
I'm interested in the fact that you have said the Obama administration should have been more prepared for the lobby assault. How come?
Well, I think that maybe he just wasn't prepared for the enormity of the influence of the lobbyist. Certainly, he's been in the Senate and in the Illinois legislature, so he knows the role and influence of lobbyists, but I don't think that he was fully prepared for the role that the lobbyists would be playing in shaping health care reform and the strength of the health insurance industry in particular in doing that through the lobbyists.
You would have been part of this effort. Explain to me what this effort was comprised of.
The effort to influence the debate?
Right.
It started actually more than 2 years ago. The insurance industry and obviously the other vested interests in the healthcare system began laying the groundwork because they knew that we would be having this debate and more than likely having it this or a year. So they had been hiring a lot of lobbyists that were new to the industry. My own last company, Cigna, began hiring a number of new lobbyists, both on the Republican side of the House and the Democratic side of the House. And these lobbyists include former members of Congress, members of the Senate, former members of the Senate and staff members, and people who are very close to Democratic senators. So they anticipated this. They began developing their strategy of how to influence lawmakers. They've been doing this for many years by funneling their campaign contributions, the executives and the political action committees, to influenceable, I guess, yes, maybe not a word, but people on the Hill, who members of Congress who are more aligned to their way of thinking ideologically, and they've been also to the point of suggesting legislative language and ideas and funneling talking points and messages to members of Congress through those lobbyists.
You know, I have read that more than $250 million has been spent on this effort. Give me an understanding of how that money has been spent.
Well, these are high-priced lobbying firms, and many of them are components of big law firms in Washington. Some are public affairs firms that have offshoots of big law firms. First of all, you pay a lot just to retain these companies. These companies also pay big PR firms lots of money to develop messaging. But just purely lobbying goes a long way. I mean, that you can spend that kind of money pretty rapidly when you've got, as you know, a trade association that is as powerful as the America's health insurance plans and the individual companies. There are 7 large health insurers now that dominate the market. They're for-profit. 1 out of every 3 Americans is enrolled in a plan offered by one of those 7 big for-profit companies. Each one of them has an army of lobbyists, some on staff and some on retainer.
You know, I, for one, have only a very slight understanding of how a lobbyist works. Give us a sense of what makes for an effective lobbying effort and how you target the individual members of Congress.
Let's take Hillary Clinton as an example. When she was in the Senate and was running for president, the CEO of Cigna really wanted to get in front of her, wanted to meet her and to at least present his point of view to her on how health care reform should take place. And Cigna hired a lobbying firm that the executives knew had some connections with the Clintons, and it worked. The lobbyist was able to, by working through Senator Clinton's staff, were able to arrange for a meeting. And the CEO was able to go to her office and spend a few minutes with her. So that's kind of how that works. And I know the senator was not necessarily influenced by what was said, but that's how it works. And many members of Congress who don't know as much about the healthcare system as Senator Clinton does certainly can be influenced by what these guys say.
And how much money would have been spent in that one single effort?
It would be hard to determine that because these lobbyists are paid on retainer, and you can find out by through certain sources how much they have to be. The companies have to file reports on how much they're paying lobbyists, but there's a time lag, so you don't know for some time. But it's certainly not unusual to pay many thousands of dollars a month to retain these high-powered lobbyists.
How do you think that the insurance industry lobbyists have shaped the debate, though, thus far?
They've shaped it by 3 different ways that legislation is shaped by the industry. One is money. Certainly money talks still, and they've been funneling money to candidates and members who are currently members of Congress for a long time. Certainly the Republican Party, they can pretty much count on every Republican vote whenever there's an issue that comes up that influences the health insurance industry. They've been focusing a lot of their attention on Blue Dog Democrats most recently. So that's where the money has been going, and it's also where the lobbying work has gone where the lobbying work is focused. They're not paying much attention to the liberals or the majority of the Democrats. They're paying attention to those that they think might be persuaded, who are from districts that could swing to be Republican if they're held by Blue Dog Democrat. Ideology makes a big difference, and they know what issues are important to a member of Congress and what would be important to constituents in that district. So they provide talking points and messaging and help with data. There was a big story in Business Week not long ago about, in fact, I think maybe the cover story currently, about how United Healthcare has provided lots and lots of data to members of Congress, and a lot of this is provided through the lobbyists. And the other way is through relationships. These members of Congress, as I noted earlier, many of these lobbyists, many are former members of Congress, many are people who used to work on their staffs, and many others are just power brokers in Washington who've had long connections with members of Congress.
And was the goal from the beginning to defeat any kind of government-run health care plan?
Absolutely. From the very beginning, that was goal number one, was to do that. And that's why, number one, why you never had any serious consideration of the single-payer legislation. Many members of Congress have signed on as sponsors of a bill that would create a single-payer system in this country that essentially would make illegal the current multi-payer system that we have right now with a lot of for-profit health insurance companies dominating. That's off the table, and Senator Baucus has said such, and others have said so too. Some have not said it, but there's no chance it will be considered seriously. But with that being off the table, they focus their attention on the other major part of both candidate Obama's and candidate Clinton's health care reform plan, which is the public insurance option. They see that as a threat, and they see that as a threat to their profitability. It wouldn't put them out of business by any means, but it might mean that they would earn a little bit less for their shareholders than they currently do. So that's paramount. They need to do this. This is for their shareholders, for their investors. That's what they're doing. They're trying to kill the public option because it might reduce profits to a certain extent.
Wendell, as you know, Norman Ornstein, David Leventhal, Andy Kohut are here in this studio. Norm Ornstein has a question for you.
Certainly.
Let me ask you this, Wendell. Given everything that you've said, and it gets us into the weeds of how governing works, just step back for a second, though, and look at the forest. Do you think that there would be any serious chance of consideration of a single-payer system, even if there were none of these lobbyists around? Would the public opinion support that? And how much of the reaction against a government plan at this point is a public unease about changing from the devil we know to the devil we don't?
Wendell.
Yeah, I think I guess we'll never know the answer to the first one because, number one, I don't think the single-payer advocates have necessarily been able to mount a successful campaign to communicate what a single-payer system is and how it would benefit Americans. So I think you're probably right. There's been an ineffective job on the part of single-payer supporters to really communicate. They haven't had the resources. They don't have anything like the amount of money that's behind the health insurance industry. So that's true. There have been a lot of members who've signed on as sponsors, but you know they're reluctant to really go on record supporting the single payer system if they think their constituents might be afraid of it.
All right, we've got to take a short break, Wendell. After that, we'll come right back to you. On the line with us until just 10:30 is Wendell Potter. He is Senior Fellow on Healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He's former Cigna Director of Public Relations. I want to ask you a quick question. Wendell, why did you leave Cigna?
I left Cigna because I felt that the kind of insurance that the industry is now promoting so heavily and almost exclusively these days is what they refer to as consumer-directed, but which features, the central feature are these high deductibles that require people, even if they have insurance, to pay a lot of money out of their own pockets before their insurance kicks in. Some employers pick up some of that, pay some of that, but many don't. And the median household income in this country is only $50,000, and the average employer sponsored plan for a family is $12,600 now. More and more people are not going to be able to afford the kinds of plans that the insurance industry is moving us all into. More and more of us can't afford, number one, the premiums, even though some premiums in these plans are less. The big problem is if you get sick or seriously injured and you're in one of these plans, you might still be facing foreclosure or bankruptcy because the bills will be so high before you get any insurance coverage. That is where I see things going in the insurance industry if we don't have significant reform and some curtailment of the way that they're behaving. They have really, through their practices, I learned toward the end of my career, forced more and more people into the ranks of the uninsured through their direct actions and also now into the ranks of the underinsured.
When you say force them into those ranks, you mean because of the increasingly high deductibles.
That's true. That's creating the big problem that is the growing problem of the underinsured. People think they've got adequate coverage, but they find out when they do need coverage that it is not there for them like they had anticipated in many regards. The other is through actions that they've been taking to satisfy Wall Street investors' interest in making sure that they spend less and less of every premium dollar on paying claims. In the early 90s, about 95 cents of every dollar you spent in premiums was used by the insurance industry to pay claims. Now it's down to just around 80 or so, give or take a few cents, 80 cents on every dollar. They have actively been purging small businesses from the rolls when an employee files big claims or gets sick or injured, because that drains their you know, makes it less they're less profitable. That shows up on the bottom line, and investors do not like that. They also have been kicking people out of the ranks of the insured by canceling or rescinding their policies when they get sick if someone has bought a policy on the individual market. So there are different ways that they get rid of those customers who are costing them most money.
If you had been directing Cigna rather than simply being in the public relations aspect of it, would you have been in favor of a public insurance option?
No, I couldn't have been. I don't guess, because I would have been accountable. Hell, I would have been held accountable by Wall Street, as the CEOs currently are. That's number one. You have to consider what your first mission is, to enhance shareholder value. So if I was answerable to Wall Street or to the investors of the company, no, I couldn't have supported a public option, because there is a good chance that it will reduce profitability. It will not put the companies out of business. But you don't want to go a single quarter with your profits dipping a little bit. You'll get punished on Wall Street if even after 3 months they see that your profitability has declined a little bit compared
and,
to previous quarters.
And now, as senior fellow on healthcare for the Center for Media and Democracy, are you in favor of a public insurance option?
Very, very strongly. I think it's the most important part of reform. It's not the only. There are many things that need to be done that will change the way insurance is provided in this country. But a public option would help a lot of people who currently don't have insurance. It would be a place where they can go to get affordable premiums or have premiums subsidized by the government, rather than going into the private market and having government subsidized the government send dollars into the treasuries of the big for-profit insurance companies, and they will again skim off a big chunk of that to go into the investors' pockets. It's very important to keep them, as the president has previously said, to keep them honest, and also to be a counter to the great influence of Wall Street.
And Andrew Kohut has a comment for you.
Well, the comment that I would make is that for insurance companies and other special interest groups, you folks have a lot to work with when it comes to public opinion. This is an issue that provokes a lot of anxiety on the part of the public. And rarely do you get in a poll 78% of the public saying, this is an issue that affects me, and 63% saying, I don't understand the debate. And therefore, you get an environment in which a lot of communications that appeal to that are directed to emotional issues such as government control of health care can move public opinion. We saw it in 1993 in the Clinton era, and we're now seeing it currently. This year started out with the public saying health care reform is one of the top issues.
Absolutely.
It was one of the criticisms people most often made of the Bush administration. And we now find the public more or less divided when we say, how do you feel about the health care reform proposals that you've been hearing about from Capitol Hill and from Barack Obama?
And is the confusion because, Wendell, of the amount of money that the lobbyists have been able to put on this?
Absolutely. Not just lobbyists, but the money also. They spend millions and millions, probably billions of dollars there, too, over time, on PR firms. They know the hot-button issues through these PR firms. They set up front groups that convey their messages. They work directly with pundits and commentators in the media. There are a lot of ways that they shape public opinion in ways that the public has no idea is going on.
Give me an example. Give me an example, Wendell.
An example occurred back during the debate on the Patients' Bill of Rights back in the 90s. The insurance industry was behind a front group that was formed to kill the Patients' Bill of Rights. It was called the Health Benefits Coalition. The public and even the media was not aware of the fact that the health insurance industry was providing the lion's share of the funding. The industry knew that it could succeed if it got the conservatives riled up about this, and part of the plan was to go to Rush Limbaugh and the conservative media and to go to the editorial page editors of publications that leaned right and to Fox News. They know how to do that. They've got connections with the media as well as on Capitol Hill.
Dave Leventhal has a question for you.
Although there's much ado about the insurance industry and the lobbying largesse there, our organization has calculated that the pharmaceutical and health products industry, in fact, has spent more on lobbying to the tune of about $134 million during the first half of this year. There's plenty of other industries and organizations that are vying for some piece of the pie here, whether it is pharma, doctors, nurses, HMO groups, hospitals. What do you see them gaining, and do you think that they've actually made as much traction, at least at this point in this debate, as the insurance industry has?
I think they have a good deal to gain. The pharmaceutical industry would certainly want to try to avoid any additional regulation or would prefer the government not get involved in the direct purchase and rate setting in the purchase of medications for Medicare beneficiaries or people who might be enrolled in a public plan. They want less regulation, and they seem to have struck a deal with the administration to try to forestall that by promising this and that. But obviously, the most focus lately has been on the insurance industry. In the past, the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical companies, the American Medical Association, medical device manufacturers have been aligned to the extent that there's always been something about the health reform legislation that they didn't like. So they've banded together in the past in some loose confederation to collectively kill reform. That's really what happened to the Clinton plan. You're seeing a little bit less of that, but it's still happening this time.
And Wendell, I know you have to get on a plane, but last question for you. What do you expect to see when Congress returns?
A huge debate over the merits of the public option and the so-called co-ops, which don't have a prayer of succeeding in the marketplace if that's what Congress goes to. But it'll be a debate largely focused on whether or not to have something like a public insurance option as part of legislation that goes to the president.
And you'd like to see that?
I think it's vital.
Wendell Potter, Senior Fellow on Healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. Get on that plane. Fly safe. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Diane.
All right. Turning to you now, Norm, did the administration miscalculate on the extent of the whole lobbying effort that was out there waiting for him starting 2 years ago?
Oh, I think they miscalculated to a degree, but I have to tell you, Diane, they actually managed the large industries much better than, say, the Clintons did. Keep in mind that in 1993, there was an all-out effort to kill any reform plan. This time, it's been a very different kind of effort. Now, it's because these industries see, with 44 million uninsured, a large new market. But the administration moved in and managed to blunt an attack on the overall plan from the pharmaceutical industry and the health insurance industry. I think where they've made a mistake is on two fronts, and it's got less to do with this lobbying. The first is that we really do have a political system that is at least as dysfunctional in 2009 as it was in 1994. The Republicans have decided as a tactic that they're going to oppose any plan. And any hope of getting even a sliver in the House, it's zero. In the Senate, we're seeing this intense pressure put on Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Mike Enzi of Wyoming, Olympia Snow of Maine, who have been trying to negotiate a plan, not to vote for anything. The second element here is, and it's a larger one, and I think it does transcend the lobbying effort, and it's what Andy referred to in the question that I asked it as well. This is never going to be easy because even though the public is in a different place in 2009 than they were in 1994, there are not only more uninsured, there are more who've been uninsured over the last few years and been dislocated. More people who leave jobs, move to another job, and find that their insurance, of course, is not portable. More people who see their costs going up. But there is still an attachment to the status quo and a fear of change that makes any kind of plan, with Washington saying, trust me, not an easy thing to do.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Andy Kohut.
Thinking about it from a tactical point of view, from the pro point of, from the pro perspective, what's really interesting is that the opponents have much more to work with in having an energized opposition. Conservatives are riled up. Liberals are not nearly as riled up among rank-and-file people.
Why not?
Because many people, ordinary people, say this is a good thing to do for the country, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing to do for me, because a lot of people feel that they're adequately covered, and a lot of people feel that the kinds of changes that might occur in healthcare reform will not necessarily be improvements for them. And there's a lot of, again, I'll go back to that word, I'll say it over and over again, anxiety, misunderstanding, and a lack of clarity as to what the choices are.
Now, whose fault is that about that issue of lack of clarity? Why is there so much confusion, Dave Leventhal?
Because this is a very, very confusing process. You're dealing with a piece of legislation that, at this point, still hasn't even been written in its final form. There are competing proposals, and there are about 101 different interest groups trying to have a stake in this and trying to influence the process. Then, of course, you just have the simple number of congresspeople who are trying to decide which way to fall on this. Let's put it this way. The health sector, and this is not even including the insurance industry, but the health sector alone has spent, like you said, more than $250 million on that. To put that in perspective, you could run the entire city government of Omaha, Nebraska for an entire year on that kind of money. And what does that mean to somebody sitting at home? It means that if you don't have health insurance, or if you think you're paying too much for health insurance, no matter which way you fall on this debate, your interests aren't necessarily being represented, surely, as much as, say, somebody who is the director of an insurance company or who represents a hospital or even a patients group. So at the end of the day, you have these interests that are going to Capitol Hill. They are lobbying to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, and that number will only grow as this debate persists. And if you think that somebody sitting at home is getting more of a say in this than somebody who has hundreds of millions of dollars to spend, that's a Pollyannish attitude.
Norman, explain the question about the deal that drug manufacturers reportedly made with the White House?
Well, you know, we've seen a number of things that have dissected this. And basically the deal, such as it is this. The pharmaceutical companies agreed that they would put in $80 billion for over 10 years to deal with a problem in the Medicare prescription drug bill, Part D, that passed a few years ago. That had built into it something called a donut hole. Basically, people got generous seniors, generous drug coverage for the first $2,500 or so, then got no coverage for the next several thousand, and it's a big jolt to poor seniors. What pharmaceutical companies agreed to do was to cut the price of drugs in that donut hole period by 50%, and in return, now, not in the future, but now in this particular bill, the administration would not push for having Medicare directly negotiate the price of pharmaceuticals or have drugs imported from Canada. There's no deal that goes beyond this bill, but it was something that the administration did so that they could get buy-in from the industry at a time when they wanted momentum and to take us away from the 1994 experience of the Harry and Louise ads and the sense that all of these industries were going to try and kill a bill entirely.
Andy.
Yeah, one of the important caveats to public opinion and the rising concern about health care reform is the polls show pretty consistent support for a public option, all of this concern notwithstanding. People are worried about what health care reform might do to them and whether it's a good thing for the country and for themselves. But just about every poll says, yeah, a public option. The majorities in about every poll say a public option makes some sense. But they go on to say, the public option is not for me. I'm going private.
But now, has the president shifted on the idea of a public option? There seemed to be some wavering on Sunday when Kathleen Sebelius made a comment, and then the president came back and made another comment. And I've asked that question, and now we're going to have to take a break. So you guys answer it. You guys answer it when we come back and take phone calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A close look at the price of perfection, from herbal energy drinks to performance-enhancing drugs and plastic surgery. Humans have searched for ways to make their bodies better. The pitfalls and benefits of pursuing physical excellence. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We'll go right to the phones to Matt in Durham, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering what the panel thinks or how the debate might have been different if instead of Kathleen Sebelius we had been seeing the White House message and at Health and Human Services run by former Senator Daschle. The White House was trying to keep things pretty close by having him in an advisory role and as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but that didn't work out, obviously. And I was wondering what the panel thought about that.
Dave Leventhal.
It would be curious to see, because he is very intimately involved in this debate right now, just not in not in the way that he was set up for, at least
initially.
He's
working with one of the insurance companies.
And is a senior advisor role, I think he goes by now. And what that speaks to is sort of a point that that we like to make a lot, and we call it the revolving door, where you have so many people who used to serve in Congress or were the staffers of congressmen who went out, have joined a lobbying firm or associate with a lobbying firm or an industry that has a stake in this, and they're coming back and they're lobbying the very Congress that they used to work for or be in.
But, Norm, if Daschle had been in that HHS position as President Obama wanted him to be and as the pusher for health reform, would we be seeing a difference?
Yes, a big difference. There have been two pieces of really awful luck for the administration. One was that Tim Geithner's nomination as Treasury Secretary came up before Daschle's. He had serious ethical issues. It caused a big flap. When Daschle's came up, it meant that his were going to be disqualifying. Had Daschle been there right at the beginning, not only as Secretary of HHS, but also as the coordinator in the White House, as somebody who had fully drawn ideas here and who knows the Senate intimately, this would have been moving much more quickly. The other problem, of course, is the tragic illness of Senator Ted Kennedy, who would have been a much more significant force of glue pulling Democrats and Republicans together in the Senate. But I think if Daschle had been there, it would have made a difference. And Daschle now, with Bob Dole in a place called the Bipartisan Policy Center, has actually come up with an alternative that may be a fallback position, just as we have another fallback. Keep in mind that Ron Wyden, a progressive senator from Oregon, and Bob Bennett, a conservative Republican from Utah, have one plan that's a sweeping change that's gotten some bipartisan support, and it's sitting there on the shelf.
It would do what?
Well, it brings a dramatic change. It doesn't give you a public plan, but it basically moves towards universal coverage with, as you gradually move from employers covering it to having subsidies. But it's also been scored by the Congressional Budget Office as revenue neutral. So it brings pretty dramatic change and gets bipartisan
support.
How
come we haven't heard more about that?
The administration from the beginning decided it didn't want to go in that direction, and none of the congressional leaders had supported it because it phases out employer-based coverage. And while that is, in general, a good idea, we have a jerry-built system. Why should employers be the middlemen in this process? Voters like what they have and would be very reluctant to move in that direction.
Dave.
Going back to Daschle, he's a very influential person and somebody who knows Congress about as well as anyone in the United States. And just like private firms and companies want to have somebody like that on their side, if the administration had a Tom Daschle on their side spearheading this, their fortunes might have been a lot different in the end.
To Western Virginia. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is pretty straightforward. This lobbying effort by the insurance industrial complex is basically vying for another Wall Street bailout for federal funds. When will the American population stand up and really fight for itself through its congressmen and senators for a public plan and other options which make financial sense?
That's what I keep wondering. Where is the American public? I hear you, Andy, that they're saying, fine, public option, but not for me. But what about the people who need this so badly?
Well, I hate to just do the numbers. They represent a relatively small share of the American public.
Without a voice.
Well, they have a voice, but they're outnumbered by people who have mixed views or feel threatened by the prospect of some of these reforms. And I think the long-term the broader question is, where will the public be and who will it hold accountable if nothing really happens here. Now, granted, people have mixed views of it, but that doesn't mean that they won't be angry if nothing happens. You know, that's the kind of doublethink you get in public opinion on an issue like this.
You know, Diane, let me just say, there's a kind of a vicious cycle here. The public doesn't trust government. And part of the reason is government doesn't do things to solve these problems.
And yet government pays their Medicare.
Sure, but you can't find a member of Congress who hasn't had an experience at a town meeting or back home with somebody saying, keep the government out of my Medicare.
Of course.
People don't understand, but they don't trust government. And when you get something as big as this, and you have government coming in and saying, trust us, we're going to make things better for you, it really is a hard sell.
But you know, it goes back to FDR. And then it jumps to Ronald Reagan, who said, government is the problem, not the solution. And we've been dealing with that phrase for decades.
There's a midpoint, though, between Reagan and FDR, and that's LBJ. In January of 1965, 66% of the public in the Gallup poll said they supported Medicare, a government system that would increase Social Security taxes. But that was at a time, following up on what Norman just said, when 70% of the public trusted government to do what's right all of the time or most of the time. We haven't seen those kinds of numbers about government since the Watergate era. And
right.
We now get, what, 31%, Norman,
yes.
In, that number?
Exactly.
Let's go to St. Louis and to Walter, who's been waiting. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I really enjoy your show every day.
Thank you.
I just wonder how France, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden were able to get a public health option plan that's working marvelously, and we can't do it in this country. It's because there's not the public will, or because big business, most importantly, the insurance industry, is controlling and directing our government.
That's a good question, David.
Their histories are very different than ours. Their governments are smaller. Their countries are smaller. And sometimes it's easier. And you've seen this even in the United States, where states or even cities have gone off on their own and taken, you look at Massachusetts, you look at San Francisco. And, you know, a lot of people have asked us, well, why didn't Obama, when he came into office, riding this wave of goodwill, just say, let's kick the lobbyists out, let's do it our way, which he was alluding to even during the campaign. The fact of the matter is, this has been so congressionally driven, and President Obama, as much as he may like to, can't control the lobbying that's going to take place in Congress. There's almost no sense to lobby the White House right now because, well, you know, his position is well known. But Congress, that's another story completely, and you've seen the fruits of that labor.
Andy.
Yeah, and there's another element in that Europeans have always been and continue to be much more comfortable with government involvement in healthcare and a whole range of social issues than our Americans. It's the difference between social democracies and the kind of democracy we have here.
All right, to Northville, Michigan. Good morning, Juanita.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you. I had one big question. First of all, I think it's outrageous that anybody tried to pass anything with all of this confusion and lack of understanding about anything. That really kind of troubles me. This public option, this is what I can't quite get my head around. It seems to me that it's like motored or directly tied into Medicare, that Medicare is going to be somewhat totally revamped or something if this public option or however that works out. I'm not sure. They say that public option is fine, but it's not for me. I'm going to stay private. My question is, next year I'm going to be 65, and I've never quite understood why I was going to be forced to go into Medicare. I consider myself as the beginning of this baby boomer generation, this big black cloud, as I refer to us as, moving through history. So I'm going to be forced to go into Medicare next year if this public option is part of what's all happening. Am I going to really not have a choice? Am I going to be forced to go into this Medicare-type situation?
All right. Norm.
Well, most Americans at 65 are eligible for Medicare. Most companies basically drop insurance at that point or provide a supplemental policy, Medicare additional, a Medicare Advantage policy. None of the things that we're talking about would affect the options available to Juanita at age 65, although there are going to be changes in Medicare that are inevitable. One of the interesting and ironic things here is that Republicans who have been fiscal conservatives have talked for a long time about how we've got to manage the long-term growth of the entitlement programs, especially Medicare, which means reducing the outlays. Now they're the champions of every bit of Medicare as they try and block this program from happening. But the unease of seniors who have what they've got are not going to be affected by most of these changes, but are afraid that it'll come on their backs is one of the major reasons that there's been resistance to any kind of health care reform.
Dave.
And the president tried to, it seemed, head that off quite quickly. One of the first speeches he gave when things really began ramping up recently was to the AARP. Now, that was by design, you better believe. And I think he's tried to quell some of those fears as much as possible, but yet they persist, and rightfully so. If you're 65, if you're 70 years old, it's almost inevitable that you are going to need drugs. You're going to need surgeries of some sort. You're going to have more health problems than perhaps you had when you were 25 or 30. So there is going to be a lot of fear. And since the story hasn't been fully written on this, that continues.
Andy Kohut, tell us what the reactions of the public are in regard to the debate itself.
Well, one of the reactions is strong interest. This is not something that you have to promote. The public is drawn to it, but as I said earlier, the public is confused by it. And the public hears just about everything. We have a poll coming out tomorrow that found 86% of the people we questioned last weekend said they had heard about the charges of these death panels. And 50% of the people who had heard about it said they're not true. But you get as many as 30% saying, you know, this just might be true. So there's a great deal of attention. And combine that attention with the emotion and lack of information that people admit, you get a very volatile, fluid public opinion.
Now, I want to go back to what Wendell Potter said about lobbying firms offering specific phrases, offering specific language to lawmakers. Did death panels come out of those lobbying efforts? There was a front page story that the former lieutenant governor of New York was the first who promoted that idea, and then it took off with Sarah Palin.
And this is, I think, a larger point we have to make here, Diane. We've been talking about the insurance companies and the other industry groups. Probably the most significant players in shaping the public views on these things have been conservative activist groups. Betsy McCoy, the former lieutenant governor, who had as much to do with killing the Clinton health care plan by picking out phrases from a thousand-page bill and distorting them. And we learned later, you know, it was wildly distorted. Did the same thing here. It was then picked up on by conservative activist groups, by the blogs, by talk radio, by Fox News, by the editorials and conservative publications, and then by Sarah Palin and others. This is not the doing of the insurance companies or the pharmaceutical companies. This is a different matter, and it has scared people.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Panama City, Florida. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Diane. My question was, I heard you saying a minute ago that one of your guests was saying that where are the American people who want this, and that there was a very small majority. But at the same time, a few minutes prior to that, one of your guests made the comment that you have these high-powered heads of insurance companies with millions of dollars at their disposal, and who's going to be hurt? Well, I think that answers the question right there. The people without the money are not hurt, whereas the people with the money are hurt.
Dave Leventhal.
One interesting phenomenon that you have seen at these town hall meetings is that there has been a swell of sort of grassroots, some might say AstroTurf type of lobbying that's been going on.
Where is that coming from?
It's coming from a lot of different places. We've had oil executives, for example, and this is outside healthcare, but try to influence companies and get their people to come out to go and sort of have a grassroots uprising against the climate change bill coming up. You see this coming up because a lot of corporations have a lot of stake in here. It's all about their bottom line. And this is sort of under the radar kind of lobbying that goes on. It has happened in the healthcare debate just as well. And you are seeing that to an extent at the town hall meetings. But of course, on the other end is people do have an opportunity to go to these town hall meetings. They don't have to be cajoled. They don't have to be pushed. They're going there and they're voicing their opinions oftentimes very strongly.
Listen, if the newspaper photographs are correct and people are going to these gatherings with rifles, with handguns, with automatic machine guns, I'm darned if I'm going to go out and be part of a group like that. It would seem to me that that's pretty scary stuff, Norm.
We've got a small number of Second Amendment fanatics, frankly, who are doing things that are just absolutely beyond the pale. The notion that you would go to a meeting where the president is going to be with a loaded assault rifle is so far over the line, I don't even know if you have a line anymore.
Okay.
That does make a difference, but just keep in mind what Andy said before. The support for this, for sweeping health care reform, is simply not nearly as intense as the opposition, and that is the biggest political factor out there.
Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Dave Leventhal of the Center for Responsible Politics, Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. Earlier, you heard from Wendell Potter. He is a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He left the Cigna Corporation, where he was director of public relations. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.